Good evening, I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, the extended ceasefire in the Middle East allows more hostages to be released, while the U.S. pushes Israel to avoid displacing more civilians in Gaza.
Abortion before the Texas Supreme Court. A group of women make the case that the state's lack of exceptions for pregnancy complications puts their lives in danger.
And a look at what's causing nurses to burn out and the risks that poses to patients' health.
You have this moral obligation to assist patients in achieving their health and wellness. When you can't do that because of systems that are in place, that's where that distress comes from.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Today was the day the war could have resumed in Gaza, with an initial truce set to expire.
Instead, it's the fifth day of a pause in fighting, the fifth day of Hamas releasing mostly Israeli hostages, Israel releasing 30 detained Palestinians, half of them women, and more aid arriving into Gaza. Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
As a fifth day of armistice allowed the fifth release of mostly Israeli hostages from Gaza and 30 Palestinians from military detention in the West Bank, there's a diplomatic push tonight to extend the pause. In Doha, CIA Director Bill Burns met with Israeli counterpart David Barnea. One of their goals, expand the hostage release agreement beyond foreign workers and Israeli women and children that have so far been released to the more than 100 Israel male hostages being held in Gaza. Hamas has indicated it's interested. The negotiations are mediated by Qatar.
We are hopeful that in the next 48 hours, we'll be getting more information from Hamas regarding the rest of the hostages.
In Israel, public sentiment is mixed.
We need all of them back home. If a truce is what will get them home, yes.
In 2 days, we should stop the ceasefire and go back to war and get rid of Hamas.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is holding on to both goals, even if most analysts believe they are contradictory.
We are committed to completing our tasks, the release of all the abductees, the elimination of this terrorist organization above and below the ground. And of course, Gaza will not return to what it was and will not pose a threat to the state of Israel.
Today, humanitarian groups warn that the 49 days of war that preceded the pause had pushed Gaza to, quote, absolute chaos. During the pause, we filmed Gazans who'd stayed in the north and finally decided to evacuate south. They walk for miles, the injured, the vulnerable, the grieving. This is Fatah.
19 members from my household, hundreds under the rubble, were from Sabra. Three families, I swear, killed.
This is Amal. She says her son died in an Israeli airstrike.
They are treating us like animals. They tell us to raise our hands in the sky while walking, take our belongings from us. We are suffering a lot. I can't take my breath because I keep walking.
A UN-led consortium today estimated Israeli airstrikes had damaged or destroyed 60% of all of Gaza's housing. The senior administration official today warned that any Israeli operation in southern Gaza would have to be a, quote, different type of campaign and avoid significant further displacement. More than three-quarters of all of Gaza is already displaced, helping spread disease, the WHO warned today.
So eventually we will see more people dying from disease than we are even seeing from the bombardment if we are not able to put back this health system and provide the basics of life, food, water, medicines, and of course fuel to operate the hospitals.
Meanwhile, in southern Gaza, today's hostage release included for the first time those held by Palestinian Islamic Jihad, a group labeled by the United States a terrorist organization. We also learned more today about how the hostages have been held. Israel's Channel 13 aired an interview with Ruth Munder, who was held overground in Gaza and released with her daughter Karen and grandson Ohad, who reunited with family on Saturday.
We were held in a suffocating room. You were not allowed to open the curtains. We were not allowed. I just opened the window for some air.
At one point, Hamas commander Yahya Sinwar visited to promise the hostages would survive.
We slept on chairs without a mattress. We covered ourselves with a sheet. That's all we had, and not everyone had a sheet. The boys slept on the ground because we wanted them next to us so they wouldn't be alone.
Ruti Munder's husband, Abraham, who, like her, is 78, was taken hostage, too. He remains in Gaza. Their son, Amna, was killed in the October 7th attack.
Nick, you've been reporting, too, on this truce extension, right? Tell us about the negotiations behind the scenes. What goes into that? Could it be extended further?
That's certainly what the U.S. is hoping for. So as you saw in our story, U.S. officials say the goal is to expand the category of hostage that Hamas would release. So far, it's been women and children. We think after tomorrow, there will be about 20 or so women and children left to be released, including two Americans. After that, the U.S. says the goal would be to get elderly men released and then civilian men out, all civilian men. And then the last category, the most difficult by far, would be female Israeli Defense Forces soldiers who are also hostage, as well as male Israeli Defense soldiers. At each step, Israel would have to expand the category, again, of Palestinian it is willing to release from its detention, from its prisons. And that is the core of what U.S. officials, intelligence officials, are in Doha right now to try and negotiate with Hamas, mediated by Qatar, try and figure out how Hamas can expand the categories and how Israel can expand the categories of detainees and prisoners it would release. The U.S. says that it wants that no matter how long it takes, but it does say that its goal is mirroring the Israeli goal to get Hamas out of Gaza entirely again, even though that those two goals aren't necessarily compatible. Get all the hostages out while at the same time allow Israel to complete its military mission as Israel defines that military mission. And on that front, as we said, the U.S. officials went much further than they have so far, warning Israel about the military operation, saying that the military operation in the south cannot displace as many Gazans as it did in the north, cannot damage or destroy as many buildings as they did in the north. A senior administration official put it this way, that if Israel doesn't change its tactics, it will be beyond the capacity of any humanitarian support network to cope. But again, strategically, the U.S. supports what Israel is trying to do, try and get Hamas entirely out of Gaza.
We'll see how those words meet actions on the ground day by day. Nick Schifrin, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
In the day's other headlines, Hunter Biden countered a subpoena from House Republicans with an offer to testify publicly before Congress. The House Oversight Committee wants a closed-door deposition for its impeachment inquiry into President Biden. But in a letter to committee chair James Comer, Hunter Biden's lawyer said, quote, "We have seen you use closed-door sessions to manipulate, even distort the facts and misinform the public." Comer then accused Biden of wanting to play by his own rules, adding, "That won't stand with House Republicans." In the Republican presidential race, the powerful Koch network formally endorsed former UN ambassador Nikki Haley today, lending her an army of activists and a huge fundraising boost. The conservative group, led by billionaire Charles Koch, argues that former President Trump cannot beat President Biden. Haley has been rising in the polls but remains far behind Mr. Trump. A rescue drama that gripped northern India for 17 days is now finally over. 41 trapped construction workers emerged from a collapsed mountain tunnel today. They were greeted with jubilation after being pulled out one by one, then were taken for medical exams. Officials say no one was seriously injured.
They all have come out from a different environment and conditions, so we will work as per the advice of the doctors. We will send them home, but first they will be kept under medical supervision. No one is in critical condition.
Rescuers had to bore and drill through nearly 200 feet of rock before they were finally able to get them out through a series of welded pipes. The workers had survived on food and oxygen supplied through narrow steel tubes. American journalist Evan Gershkovich will stay in Russian pretrial detention until at least January 30th. A Moscow court issued that order today. The Wall Street Journal correspondent appeared briefly at the proceeding, but did not speak. He was arrested in March on espionage charges, but the U.S. says he is wrongfully detained. And here at home, the holiday shopping season is off to a strong start. The National Retail Federation reports more than 200 million shoppers took advantage of Thanksgiving weekend deals. And the data tracking firm, Adobe Analytics, says spending jumped nearly 8% from a year ago. The numbers were well above expectations. And on Wall Street, stocks nudged a little higher after a strong report on consumer confidence. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 83 points to close at 35,417. The NASDAQ rose 40 points. The S&P 500 added 4. Still to come on the NewsHour, the late former First Lady Rosalynn Carter is honored at a service in Georgia. And a program in Louisville, Kentucky amplifies unheard voices through the power of publishing.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Texas Supreme Court today heard arguments in a case brought by a group of 20 women who say they've been denied emergency care because of the state's abortion laws, some of the nation's most restrictive. They argue that the medical exceptions in the state's abortion bans are too narrow to protect patients who face pregnancy complications. The case marks the first time patients denied abortions have sued a state since Roe was overturned. Taylor Edwards, who is one of the plaintiffs, and Molly DeWayne, their lead attorney, join us now. Thank you both for being with us. And Taylor, we'll start with you. Tell us your story about why you had to leave Texas and go to Colorado to receive care.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I guess I can start my story back I went through a long IVF journey to get pregnant in the first place. It was actually our third embryo transfer that worked. And so we were highly monitored throughout the pregnancy and everything was going really smoothly until we got to our anatomy scan. And when we were given a fatal diagnosis of an encephalocele. And so she was essentially never going to live if she made it to birth. And having to kind of sit there with your doctor and them tell you, we can't help you, here's a number to call, that's kind of what we were left with after that appointment. And so we had to call out of state. We had to go to New Mexico first. We tried to get a clinic. We had an appointment with a clinic there. And 3 hours before we were supposed to board a plane to New Mexico, they canceled the appointment due to a shortage of medication. So we were left to kind of scramble. I was 18 weeks pregnant at that point and trying to, like, I was worried I was going to be too far along. It was a whole thing. And so I tried to find another clinic in New Mexico that was available, and there was none. And so we had to rebook everything to go to Colorado just to receive medical care. I mean, it took a feat to get through all of that logistics, and traveling is stressful enough already when you're even just, like, going on vacation. So going through the most traumatic experience of your life while traveling is just an extra layer.
Did the doctor in Texas explicitly say that they could not provide care because of the state's abortion laws?
Yes. He said, my hands are tied. If this would have happened a year and a half ago, I would have been able to provide you an abortion in the hospital here with your doctor.
Molly, how common are stories like Taylor's?
Well, Taylor's story is horrible, but it is not unique. Unfortunately, this is something that is happening daily in places like Texas, along with all the other states, you know, 13, 14 states in the United States where abortion is now banned. And while there are technically medical exceptions on the books, as Taylor's experience shows, they simply do not function in practice.
So what then is the ultimate goal with this lawsuit, Molly?
Well, the goal with this lawsuit is so that people like Taylor will not have to go through the extreme trauma that she went through. We have in this case, it began with 5 women. It is now up to 20 women, which just shows how widespread the problem is in Texas as well as other states around the country. And the goal is to help women, right? And to make sure that doctors can actually provide medical care, which is what an abortion is. It is standard reproductive medical care that women and pregnant people routinely need for any number of reasons. And in some ways, this lawsuit is very small. It is just about being able to make sure that the medical exception that exists under Texas's law actually functions in practice. But in other ways, it is quite large because Taylor and her co-plaintiffs are showing an unbelievable amount of bravery and self-sacrifice to tell their stories publicly so that the public can understand abortion is healthcare and what is happening in states across the country is unconscionable and should not continue anymore.
What are the penalties for physicians who violate Texas's abortion laws?
They could not be more extreme. We are talking about life in prison, loss of medical license, and hundreds of thousands of dollars in civil fines. So quite understandably, physicians are terrified. They don't know when or how close to death a patient needs to be before they can provide abortion care. And they have been begging the Texas Medical Board and the rest of the state for guidance for years, and it has fallen on deaf ears. So here we are. We came to court. Courts are places that can vindicate constitutional rights, and Taylor has constitutional rights just like everyone else in Texas.
The Assistant Attorney General in Texas makes the point that the law is clear enough and that the problem, if there is one, lies with the doctors. Here's what she had to say earlier.
If, as she said, a woman is bleeding or has amniotic fluid running down her legs, then the problem is not with the law. That is with the doctors. I mean, that woman clearly would qualify for the medical emergency exception. And so if she has to come to court to make that happen, that is not the state's fault.
So, Molly, what's your response to that argument?
Well, my response is that the state has been saying over and over again the exception is clear, yet they have never once told us what they think the exception means. In fact, contrary to what they said today, they have made every attempt to show that amniotic fluid does, in fact, need to be running down a patient's leg before they can come to court. What Taylor said that her doctor said to her is verbatim what I have heard from every single one of my clients, which is my doctor said that her hands were tied. And who tied them? It was the state of Texas.
Taylor, how did you hear about this lawsuit and why did you feel compelled to join it?
Yeah, so as soon as we got home from Colorado, I contacted multiple news outlets because I felt like people needed to know. I felt like there's surely no way that people that this is happening and people just don't know about it because it's so horrible. So I contacted a local station, Fox 7, here in Austin. My husband and I gave an interview, I think, weeks after we got back from Colorado, and Molly saw that interview and reached out to me, and I knew immediately I wanted to join the suit. I mean, it wasn't even a question because I went public with my story to make change and to bring awareness, and that's what this lawsuit is doing. I think it's really important. All of our stories are different and horrifying, but very, very important.
How are you and your husband doing now?
We're hanging there. I'm actually currently pregnant. My last IVF transfer worked 4 months after we lost our daughter. So that's been a new experience. Yeah, it's been tough. Being pregnant in Texas again is really scary, and I don't have any living children, or I wouldn't have gone through this again because it's just a really scary time to be a pregnant person in Texas.
Taylor Edwards, thank you for sharing your story with us. And Molly Duane, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
A series of private and public memorials are being held for former First Lady Rosalynn Carter this week. Today, she was honored in Atlanta, Georgia.
As in her life, faith, service, and duty were at the center of Rosalynn Carter's memorial. As family, friends, and dignitaries filled Glenn Memorial United Methodist Church to pay their respects to Mrs. Carter, who died in her Plains, Georgia home on November 19th at the age of 96.
Today, let us affirm together the faith Rosalynn lived so beautifully. Death, though real, does not have the last word.
Her husband, Jimmy Carter, now 99, made his first public appearance in September, joined by fellow former President Clinton and President Biden. And a rare convening as every living First Lady gathered in Atlanta to remember one of their own. Some of Mrs. Carter's favorite hymns peppered the service. And Bible verses wove her beliefs throughout.
Serve one another humbly in love, for the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself.
When great souls die, the air around
us. Tony Loudon has been the Carters' personal pastor.
We breathe briefly. Our eyes are filled with hurtful clarity, and our memory suddenly sharpens, examines the words unsaid and promises of walks never taken.
Speakers recalled a dedicated servant, First Lady, global humanitarian, and fierce advocate for mental health and social justice. Catherine Cade was a longtime aide and friend of Mrs. Carter's. She serves as vice chair of the Carter Center's Board of Trustees.
What a remarkable woman she was. Wife, mother, business manager, political strategist, diplomat, advocate, author. Yet what I remember most about her was her tireless dedication to taking care of others.
The NewsHour's Judy Woodruff covered the Carters and reflected on their decades-long friendship.
What we witnessed was a First Lady who saw her role as going well beyond the essential, warm, and welcoming host to being a close and trusted, yes, advisor. In essence, an extension of the President himself. A First Lady who understood the weight of her words and especially her actions. Without Rosalynn Carter, I don't believe there would have been a President Carter.
And daughter Amy shared a letter her father wrote to Rosalynn 75 years ago while serving in the Navy.
While I'm away, I try to convince myself that you really are not, could not be, as sweet and beautiful as I remember. But when I see you, I fall in love with you all over again. Does that seem strange to you? It doesn't to me. Goodbye, darling. Until tomorrow. Jimmy.
The Carter's grandson and Georgia politician, Jason Carter, remembered his late grandmother.
My grandmother doesn't need a eulogy. Her life was a sermon. And it was a mighty testament to the power of faith and to the power of a deep and determined love.
Tomorrow, the Carter family will hold a private funeral at their home church in Plains. Rosalynn Carter's final resting place will be a plot within sight of the Carter's home porch.
And you can watch the former First Lady's full memorial service on our website. That's pbs.org/newshour.
Last year, nearly half of all U.S. health workers reported they often feel burned out. That's according to a new federal study. Research suggests that nurses are especially vulnerable, and that can affect the care they provide. In collaboration with the Global Health Reporting Center, with support from the Pulitzer Center, Stephanie Tsai reports from Columbus, Ohio, for our series, Critical Care, the Future of Nursing.
It's a typical weeknight in Sarah Kincaid's home, rushing to find her daughter's soccer cleats.
What sound does H mean?
Keeping her four-year-old busy, releasing the family's herd of ducks.
Hi, Lois. How are you today?
Kincaid is also a full-time nurse in Columbus, Ohio, a 40-minute drive away.
My patients know I celebrate with them when we hit milestones. They've made a change with their diet. They've quit smoking. We hoot and holler and we dance around.
Which homework do you want to do first?
But all that passion, along with obligations back at home and a lack of administrative support, can take a heavy emotional toll.
Nurses are especially vulnerable because of the caring role we play. I was experiencing extreme levels of stress, anxiety, went on maternity leave. And during that time, I was like, I don't know that I want to go back.
Research shows that nurses suffer disproportionately from mental health conditions. Even before the pandemic, the risk of suicide among female nurses was nearly twice the risk in the general population and 70% higher than among female physicians. Today, hospital nurses are much more likely to report burnout than their physician counterparts. At Ohio State University, Bern Melnick is sounding the alarm. She's a nurse herself and the first chief wellness officer of any U.S. university system.
It is absolutely urgent. My studies have shown the more depressed and burnout you are, the more preventable medical errors that are made. So not only is it unhealthy for our population, but it adversely impacts healthcare quality and patient safety.
Blood pressure control
Melnick says she's taking an evidence-based approach to creating a culture of wellness across Ohio State's hospitals and academic colleges.
I have a philosophy, in God we trust, but everybody else better bring data to the table.
You're a data person.
Absolutely.
I like that.
So nurses, for example, who believe their organization has a culture that invests in their well-being, there's much less burnout, much less depression and stress.
A culture of wellness may sound intangible, but Melnick says it leads to real, measurable benefits, over 3 times the return on investment at OSU.
When is the best time to present that content and material?
It must begin with our students. Self-care is a necessity, not a nicety.
An urgent necessity. Nearly 18% of newly licensed registered nurses quit the profession within the first year.
Another thing we talk a lot about is gratitude.
Taylor Schwein is a psychiatric nurse practitioner in training. She teaches a cognitive skills building program for fellow OSU students called MindStrong.
Help us to kind of get the not.
Its benefits are backed up by 20 studies.
We also measure levels of stress, anxiety, and depression with validated survey tools, and we consistently see that those 3 levels decrease after taking MindStrong.
I could pull on, I could feel that sense of
MindStrong found Schwein's peer, Yang Du, at a critical juncture, questioning her success as a student nurse and struggling with what she calls passive suicidal thoughts.
Just doing self-statement really boosts your self-esteem, right? You keep giving yourself the positive influence. Yeah, I'm good. I'm a good nurse. I'm caring. I'm making a difference. And that reminds you of how great you are.
There is an outsized need for support programs like this one. A national survey of 7,000 nurses earlier this year found 2/3 were not receiving any kind of mental health support. Nurses' 24/7 schedules can be part of the problem.
I remember working night shift, and there were a lot of things that day shift would have access to, but night shift, we didn't have those things. It has to be available for to meet nurses where they are.
Along with MindStrong, Ohio State offers a peer-to-peer wellness counseling program.
I talk about wellness. I talk to students about wellness.
These things work. Mindfulness is evidence-based, really decreases stress and anxiety. Cognitive behavior skills building, and that is all about teaching people to catch, check, and change automatic, unhelpful thoughts.
Ohio State is also making some innovative new investments, including golden retriever Shiloh, one of 37 therapy dogs who visit Wexner Medical Center, not for patients, but clinicians.
Yeah.
One factor pushing nurses to the brink, the pressures of a profit-driven healthcare system.
That amount of time we're spending to get to know the patient, developing a plan of care that is patient-centered, that should be valued financially more than the number of people who are coming through that office.
Kincaid says less time to see more patients and high drug costs, among other industry profit incentives, can run counter to a nurse's most sacred duty.
You have this moral obligation to assist patients in achieving their health and wellness. When you can't do that because of systems that are in place, that's where that distress comes from. That's where that frustration, that burnout. There's only so many times you can hit your head against a wall.
Researchers call this feeling moral injury and find it can lead clinicians to depression and even post-traumatic stress disorder. Some stressors are hard to see, except for the people who deal with them every day. Ease of use issues with the electronic health record or EHR systems have also been linked to higher rates of burnout. Nationally, more than 1/3 of nurses surveyed say they spend excessive time working on inputting stats in a computer, on breaks, or after shifts.
When you think about why people went into nursing, it's because they love people, but a lot of the joy in taking care of people has been taken away in large part because of many tasks that need to be done.
If you find it's going to be longer, let me know. Give me a call, shoot me my chart.
While I think the conversation regarding wellness needs to continue, I think we need to go beyond just a conversation. We need to take care of our nurses. We need to take care of our healthcare providers.
Taking care of nurses so they can take care of us. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Ohio.
Ordinary people with extraordinary stories. That is the ethos behind the Louisville Story Program, which is celebrating 10 years of amplifying unheard voices and untold stories. Jeffrey Brown went to Kentucky to see the power of writing one's own story. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
The beauty, the power, the precision of thoroughbreds on the racetrack. Familiar images of Churchill Downs. But there's another side to life at the home of the Kentucky Derby, the so-called backside. That's the term for where 22-year-old Merline Cano Hernandez has been working since she was 11, alongside family members who've come over the years from Guatemala.
A lot of people don't know about what goes on here, all of the different roles everyone plays back here, and how that it's like the most important one for what happens at the front.
For many workers on the backside, work can start as early as 4 a.m., sometimes 7 days a week, grooming, training, walking the horses.
There's like so many people that I think like I can't count them with like my hands right now. For me, it was really important and really amazing to be able to tell like the readers a little bit of how it is to like work back here.
Cano Hernandez is one of 31 contributors to the book Better Lucky Than Good, Tall Tales and Straight Talk from the Backside of the Track. It was published in 2019 by the nonprofit Louisville Story Program and distributed to readers here and around the country. The program was created to tell stories by and about its community. Among them, In Heaven Everyone Will Shake Your Hand, which features the work of self-taught artist Julie Baldiga. The Fights We Fought Have Brought Us Here, from 10 young writers from the high school Muhammad Ali attended. And No Single Sparrow Makes a Summer, the stories of young Louisville women who collectively speak 9 languages and have lived in 7 countries.
Always good to see you, man.
Thank you, man. Appreciate you. Okay. Talk to you next time.
Right. Raven Churchill helped write I Said Bang, a history of the Dirt Bowl, the crown jewel of what locals call the most basketball-obsessed city in America. It details the annual summer basketball tournament held in West Louisville since 1969. There was much lore from the early days, including one tournament in particular that attracted thousands. But Churchill says,
there's no pictures of it. There's no video of it. There's no way to document it. So we wanted to be able to, for the next generation of, you know, dirt bowlers and people who, you know, enjoy Louisville basketball in the summer, to be able to go back and look and be like, hey, this is where it started. And so, because this, not a lot of people I know sit down and read books these days. So I didn't really know what to expect, but the response that we got was overwhelming.
This is a shot from the 1950s from the Louisville Defender.
Behind these efforts is a small team led by Darcy Thompson, executive director of the Louisville Story Program, who on this day was literally sifting through history to tell the story of Louisville's 20th century black photographers whose work has been hidden unprotected in basements and garages, inaccessible to the public.
We link arms with folks like that who want to tell the stories of their communities and want to author those stories. And we accompany them in the process of developing nonfiction, like documentary books, radio stories, exhibits, in which they document the richness and vividness of their communities from the inside.
And it really becomes about voice, right? Individual voice, yes. Which somehow you have to help bring out. Yes. What's the key to that?
That's a great question, because we, you know, someone who is a little newer to this kind of process, you know, they've done a lot of writing in school and often been sort of told to write in ways, certain ways that may not be their voice. And we basically, you know, encourage them, you don't have to worry about the sort of formal things. Like, just kind of let it out. We try to be sensitive and not push them away from their voice, you know.
Operating in this small basement office of Spalding University, the team works to curate the past. Deputy Director Joe Manning was taking old recordings of gospel music gone missing, hidden in closets and attics, and digitizing them as part of I'm Glad About It, Louisville Gospel Restoration Project. In the mid-20th century, the city was a hotbed of gospel producing and recording.
All the saints of God are gathering home.
Manning took us to see fifth-generation gospel singer Wilma Claiborne, who ran a record label called Grace Gospel and a record store by the same name in the 1970s and 80s. She was rehearsing with her grandson, recording and performing artist Jason Claiborne, and spoke of the history she wants to put into the book.
The talent in Louisville was so powerful. We moved to a store. It was owned by a church, and we rented it was two or three rooms. And we set up the records. And I said, well, this is records. We've got to have gospel music in here. So that's what started the gospel music industry in Louisville. For me, there were no other stores that were selling gospel music.
That was taken here in Louisville after a program.
If you don't write the history or tell somebody the history is lost. I found that the history of gospel music has been lost pretty much.
Another story being worked on, the incarceration of Chiquita Tinsley and others, for a book in process titled Tracing Grout Lines in Cinder Blocks.
Louisville Story Program allowed me to kick the door off the hinges.
Tinsley grew emotional at the realization she would be recognized as a published author.
It makes me say that I am one, because I have so many journals, you know, that I've written in, you know, in private. And, you know, because, you know, I was afraid to share my writings with people.
It helps our city know itself.
Know itself.
Yes, really know. And then our role is also to shout from the rooftops, you need to listen to this. You need to read this, what this person wrote. You need to understand all this.
Darcy Thompson ended this day gathering material from another generation-strong gospel family, the Pimpleton Singers, known for carrying on the gospel quartet tradition. One more part of this city's history now being preserved. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in Louisville, Kentucky.
Over the last 5 years, more than 170 churches have joined the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown III's mission to address disenfranchisement and food insecurity. Tonight, Reverend Brown shares his brief but spectacular take on nourishing the mind, body, and soul.
One of the things that I learned about being a pastor was that so much of my work went far beyond Sunday morning. I really was sharing life with people. And as I shared life with members of our church, I learned so much about the pressing matters of their lives, like their health, like their finances, like their food needs in their households. And that pulled my heart to do something more and do something different with respect to how I showed up as a pastor. I was a pastor for 14 years, and after 14 years, I left the pulpit, went to the farm. So my ministry continues, but now I'm kind of a preacher and a farmer all together. While I was pastoring Pleasant Hope Baptist Church, I noticed that many of the members of our congregation were being hospitalized repeatedly for diet-related issues. When I noticed that pattern, and I recognized that the nutrient-rich food that we needed was too expensive for me and our members, we started growing our own food. I watched that garden transform the lives of the people of that church. The magic was in the garden and in the food. I was led to establish a national organization called the Black Church Food Security Network. The church has served as a hub for the African American community, and so it only makes sense to utilize the existing assets of the church in order to address our food and health concerns. Now, we're upwards of 250 member congregations and more than 100 black farmers in our directory as well. The misconception that the black community is wholly deficient when it comes to addressing health challenges and food insecurity is a dangerous one, because what I have seen is that in these same communities where there is high prevalence of diabetes and kidney challenges and heart disease, there are also the ingredients to help address and overcome those very challenges. What we do have in black communities is relationships, heritage, history, and yes, faith institutions, many of which have been around for 100 plus years, that can serve as a stable bedrock and foundation for the co-creation of a more just, ethical food system that's better for people and the planet. I'm Reverend Dr. Heber Brown III, and this is my brief but spectacular take on nourishing mind, body, and soul through African American church communities.
And you can watch more brief but spectacular videos online at pbs.org/newshour/brief.
And we'll be back shortly with a story about a Native tribe in Minnesota that welcomed home their ancestors' remains more than a century after they were removed.
But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps keep programs like this one on the air.
For those of you staying with us, we have an encore report on what was once the most popular sport in the U.S., cricket. It was overtaken by baseball in the years after the Civil War, but it's now seeing a resurgence thanks in part to thriving South Asian American communities who revere the game. The story originally aired on PBS News Weekend.
It's game day in Germantown, Maryland. Players warming up, parents settling in on the sidelines, and the unmistakable sound of summer in America, the crack of bat against ball. But it's not baseball that brought these crowds out today, it's cricket.
One, two, three, four breaks!
On this Sunday, two local youth cricket academies are squaring off. Those are the Mavericks in red and the Jaguars in blue. One of the first batters up for the Jaguars is 12-year-old Akash Venkatesh, whose journey to cricket was a long one.
What was your first sport?
Soccer.
And then after that?
Tennis.
And then after that?
Badminton.
Was there any sport you didn't try?
Football, because too much contact.
And I hear that.
With other sports, I like played it, I had fun, but then it got boring after a couple weeks. With cricket, I just like felt that spark.
A spark fanned into an all-consuming passion by his parents, including mom Sunita, who dutifully drives Akash and big brother Aditya to dozens of matches every year across Maryland and Virginia.
We just love it. I see the games going on. I see parents cheering, supporting their kids. The love keeps going on.
Cricket keeps this family close. It also fills every corner of their home, from trophies lining the shelves.
One of these ones I hit 100, and this one here, no, not this one, this one here was...
There's so many, you get them confused.
To a makeshift practice pitch in the basement. Much of that enthusiasm comes from dad, Venki, who grew up loving the game in India.
I started playing cricket, you know, right when I was probably 8 or 9 years old, and I had a dream built around, you know, cricket. One day I wanted to be a cricket player.
When the couple moved to America, more American sports took center stage.
We introduced them to all the American sports initially. Mm-hmm. They tried tennis, soccer, basketball, swimming, but after a couple of weeks, the energy died down. Mm-hmm. And cricket was the last sport that was introduced to them.
And this time, it stuck.
we all played at some point or watched it. Sometimes we like put it on the TV and then watch it all together. It's just a fun thing to do together.
The family trains together, honing the boys' skills in a game that's now catching on across the country. And it's not as easy as it looks.
We'll end on that.
Cricket was invented in 17th century England and spread across the globe with the British Empire, arriving in Australia, the West Indies, and India by the 18th century. The game is played on a 360-degree field, with batters on one team trying to score runs by hitting the ball past fielders and a pitcher, known as a bowler, on the opposing team, all while protecting their wickets from the ball. It remains most popular in former British colonies like India, Pakistan, South Africa, and Australia. So why is this old British game taking off in the United States?
A confluence of things is happening.
Aishwarya Kumar of ESPN says immigration to the U.S. from cricket-obsessed nations is one reason.
The South Asian American population is exponentially increasing. It was 3.4 million back in 2010, and it's 5.4 million now.
Another is live streaming cricket, keeping fans connected to the highest level of play, like the Indian Premier League, no matter where they live.
There's a global movement around, okay, we can stay in India and Australia and still watch cricket that's happening in the U.S.
Another reason, money. As the audience has grown here, so has the financial investment.
A lot of resources being poured into building stadiums and actually like making sure that there is infrastructure in place and resources in place to develop something from scratch and get people excited here.
That something, Major League Cricket, or MLC, launched this summer, an American competition hoping to win viewers around the world.
We think for the casual American sports fan who's never seen a game should come and take a look at one, and I think they'll be hooked.
Vijay Srinivasan is co-founder of the league.
It's not the traditional image of cricket that many people in America have, which lasts several days and, you know, there's people dressed in white clothes and sit down for a cup of tea and break for lunch and so on.
The league, featuring six teams from across the country, was a passion project for Srinivasan. He founded a live streaming cricket channel in the early 2000s, which showed him there was a viewer base in the U.S. hungry for elite competition. This season sold out most games, and Srinivasan says there are plans to build more stadiums and infrastructure.
That's going to change the landscape for cricket hugely in this country, and hopefully with the Cricket World Cup coming to the U.S. next year, it's going to be a very different picture a few years from now.
A picture that may feature future pros like Akash and Aditya, who's now trying out for the under-19 Team USA.
So I'm going to ask you both a question, and I want you to both answer at the same time on the count of three. Ready? Who's the better player? One, two, three, go.
At the moment,
maybe. I'm excited, you know, because, I mean, now, like, the cricket here is getting a lot better. So at the end of the day, if we become, like a great nation in cricket, we might be rivaling up against India, Pakistan, those kinds of teams. That it's going to be fun.
What's it like for you as a parent to watch your children succeed in this sport that clearly means so much to you?
It's kind of a dream come true. Nothing else apart from that. And I can say I'm living my dream through them.
A dream carried across an ocean and a generation that found new life here in the U.S.
A Native American tribe in Minnesota recently welcomed home five of its ancestors, more than a century after their remains left the state. Their burial sites had been looted by a white landowner who took them to Connecticut. The remains sat in a basement until state officials stepped in, hoping to right a wrong. As Native American Heritage Month comes to a close, reporter Kayomi Lee of Twin Cities PBS has this story.
On this October day, despite the bitter wind and cold, a homecoming occurred. Some 120 years after being removed from their graves in Minnesota, five Dakota ancestors finally came home. Dozens of members of the Prairie Island Indian community gathered at a burial site an hour south of Minneapolis. It was a sacred ceremony, one we were not allowed to film. The ancestors were carried down the hill as drums rang out. A ceremonial fire was lit, and their remains were placed on scaffolding in the open air. This lasted 4 days, as is custom, until their final burial.
It's a feeling of excitement for many.
Frankie Jackson is with the tribe's Historic Preservation Office and was one of the organizers.
What it allows them to do is to come together as community and put together this burial practice to welcome relatives back.
It's an unusual story. There aren't many instances where human remains that were excavated in the 19th century have survived this long.
Historian Paul Maravellis researches the area where the ancestors originally were buried, Lake Minnetonka, on the western outskirts of Minneapolis.
Lake Minnetonka has a heavy concentration of mounds. Some archaeologists claim that it's one of the most dense areas of mound building in this southern Minnesota.
In 1875, an attorney from Connecticut named Carrington Phelps acquired an entire island on Lake Minnetonka. He renamed it Phelps Island and built a lodge. It was also home to two Native American burial mound groups. The lake was considered sacred to the Dakota and other tribes who used it as their final resting place.
Almost 500 mounds at Lake Minnetonka that were counted and mapped in the 1880s. Most of these were excavated at Lake Minnetonka by 1890. There wasn't a sense that they should be preserved as we think today.
And also, were they novelties, souvenirs, people grave digging?
Absolutely.
In 1902, Phelps lost ownership of the island. He had already moved back to Colebrook, Connecticut, a few years earlier. It's believed he took with him Native ancestors who were buried on the island. Their remains were given to the Colebrook Historical Society a decade ago when his descendants sold the house. According to the Colebrook Historical Society, the family made no effort to hide the fact that he brought the bones back after he destroyed the mound. Over the years, they showed them to people as if they were souvenirs. They eventually made their way to the Connecticut State Archaeology Office. That agency complied with a federal law called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. It requires institutions that are federally funded or located on federal land to identify and return indigenous ancestral remains and objects to the Native nations to which they belong. But 33 years after it became law, anthropologists like Carlton Shield Chief Gover says compliance is falling short.
Museums have too much stuff that has remained unanalyzed and unstudied since it was recovered in 1930s, 1940s, and no one's touched it since. We still have so much stuff that has remained unanalyzed.
A ProPublica investigation this year found that a handful of American institutions, including prestigious museums and government entities, still had not repatriated large numbers of Native American ancestors. The law doesn't address Native remains in private collections, as was the case with these ancestors. That helps explain why it took so long to return them to Minnesota.
The relatives that are coming back here now is just one example of the tribes working collectively to reconcile relatives outside of Minnesota.
Frankie Jackson says bringing home their ancestors has been rewarding and worth the effort.
To play just a small role in that is incredibly rewarding and satisfying. But more importantly, for the Dakota Oyate that reside here in Minnesota, it's one of those ultimate acts of sovereignty to be able to reclaim our relatives in this way.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Kaomi Lee in Welch, Minnesota.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us.